Okay, folks, welcome to the latest edition of Life on Planet Porky, the podcast that takes you beyond the celestial barriers of Earth, I should say, and into a different stratosphere. And once again, and I'm sure that Leslie Ann will endorse this, I want to thank you all for the fantastic feedback that we've been getting over the last couple of podcasts. And we really mean it. I certainly really mean it when I say that, you know, getting a response from you makes it all really worthwhile, does it not, Leslie Ann?
That makes my day. I have to say, every single time, every message, people taking the time to contact us and say how much they're enjoying it. So, so grateful for that. Thank you.
Yeah, we are indeed. Now, coronavirus, of course, we can't be endlessly talking about that. We don't want to, and that's why we try and take you elsewhere. But I want to, pat myself a little bit on the back here, Leslie Ann, because I've had a campaign all the way through this to try and get the pubs open sooner rather than later, but in as safe a fashion as possible. Because though I don't want to cause people any harm or any trouble, I do think that the English pub is so central to our way of life, I want it to be open. So I was pretty pleased to have read over the last 36 hours headlines and stories on social media that the government are now considering opening those pubs, perhaps in the second or third week of June. I'm absolutely thrilled. I know you've got your doubts, but you can only agree with me that the pubs have been the core of our business for a long, long time.
Of course they have. I still can't get my head around how we're going to stand at the bar and order drinks. I know you say we can do it by app, or we can queue, there's a one-way system, in and out, all of that. But where do you get the atmosphere from in those conditions?
Well, it's not necessarily just the atmosphere. I love the British pub. I love English pubs, Welsh pubs, Scottish pubs, Irish pubs, because of what they are. I don't go there to get bladderated, you know, per se. I go because of, as you quite rightly say, the atmosphere. But the atmosphere in a pub for me is not necessarily how many people are in there. It's the design and the structure of the pub. For instance, I saw the great model Jodie Kidd doing a piece from her pub the other day. She's got a great country pub somewhere in the Shires of England. And it was one of these pubs with tall stools at the bar, brass, you know, polished brass plates around the bar, wooden tops, and it just looked fantastic. And I thought, that is what I go to pubs for. And talking about her being famous and having a pub, of course, lots of famous people have got pubs, like our old friend Piers Morgan. And you have revealed recently to me, Leslie Ann, that you and your dad once talked about getting a pub.
Oh, we talked about it for years. My father had an enormous amount of sports memorabilia from all his years touring the globe with the great sporting teams and covering the prize fights, you know, the World Cups, the Olympics and so on. So he wanted to have his own pub called The Back Page. Yeah. And we would decorate the inside of the pub with all his memorabilia. And that would be a great sort of journalistic tribute to sports writers and to journalism in general. Ooh. And it was a dream of ours, and I wish we'd done it.
Yeah, and where would it have been? Somewhere in Wales?
No, I think in London it would have had to be, in the sort of vicinity of Fleet Street.
Yeah? Oh, fantastic. Well, that's a dream you had. I'd love to have a pub, but they're very hard work. And the other problem with pubs is that if you come from sort of our world, and I'm referring now to my colleague, Mr. Alan Brazil, Al had a pub in Ipswich called the Black Adder. And the problem is that you attract so many people from our business and so many people from the previous business that Al was in, which was football, that actually you end up hardly ever charging anybody for a drink because, you know, they all think they're your mates and they come down, yeah, you know, no, on the house and all that kind of stuff. So it's not a good thing to run if you're a popular person. Now, last time we spoke, no, since we last spoke, I have celebrated the, is it 71st or 72nd birthday of Stevie Nicks? And I did not realise, Leslie Ann, a woman you know very well.
Well, yes, I do. And she was actually 72 this week.
Wow.
Can you believe? I mean, she does look amazing. She's still got the long blonde hair. I don't know whether it's a wig or not. The last time I went to see Fleetwood Mac, I did sort of study that quite assiduously from the side of the stage, thinking, is that her real hair? It does look really good, whatever.
Yeah.
But she's had a kind of topsy-turvy time, hasn't she, really? I back in the 80s, I went to rehab with her. She was in the Betty Ford Clinic for cocaine addiction.
Yeah.
You know, they lived at large, didn't they, Fleetwood Mac?
Oh, yes.
And everybody knows the story about Rumours, the album being this sort of catalogue of their relationship breakups, all of them.
Yeah.
They were having affairs, marriages were breaking down, they were cross-pollinating left, right and centre.
Yeah.
And it was epic. The way they destroyed themselves.
Mm.
And I think Stevie was doing all of it more than the rest of them put together.
Mm.
And she did end up in the Betty Ford, where the treatment, you know, this place was founded by the former First Lady of the US, who had endured her own battle with alcohol dependency and diazepam addiction, I think it was.
Yeah.
Stevie's was more straightforward. It was cocaine.
Mm.
But there was no special treatment for her. They all had their little sort of cubicles that they lived and slept in, but they had to share, and she was sharing with an old lady.
Mm.
But Stevie's routine was astonishing because she would get up every single morning and she would put on Stevie Nicks. So she would do the full makeup, the full stage look, all the petticoats and the shawls and the gloves and the fans and the whole bit, and the platform heels, you see. So she would stagger out of her cubicle and then her job for the day would be allocated, and they had to clean the clinic.
Yeah.
So she would be swabbing the corridors with bucket and mop, dressed like Stevie Nicks about to go on stage. It was hilarious.
And you're allowed in to see her during her course of treatment.
Yes, I did an interview with her, and she had befriended three old guys, as she called them. They were probably only in their early 60s or something, but they were all in rich, you know, captains of industry, all in there getting off various, you know, drink, drugs, whatever, sex probably. Yeah. It's usually about sex, isn't it?
Yeah.
And she befriended these three old guys, and they all had tea together every afternoon. And the fans knew that she was in there because every single day to the clinic were delivered literally van loads of bouquets, plants, orchids, all kinds of stuff. And of course, she couldn't keep them all. So she used to go around with a trolley distributing all her gifts to all the other people in the clinic. She was a really lovely woman. I liked her very much.
Well, I love the stories about Fleetwood Mac, as you quite rightly say, such a fascinating group. You know, not only all the drugs and excesses and all that, but the bankruptcies. You know, Mick Fleetwood went bust about four times, I think, or something like that, and had his house in Malibu seized and all that kind of stuff. But the one great story I love about Stevie Nicks is that when Fleetwood Mac were the, you know, the biggest band in the world and they were on tour around the world, she used to always demand the presidential suite in whichever hotel they went to. And she always demanded that by the time she got there, the whole thing had been painted pink. I mean, like everything, the walls, the carpets were changed and pink carpets were put in. The ceilings were painted pink. Her piano that she always demanded in her suite had to be pink. Everything had to be pink. And then when the band left after, say, a two-night stay, that room, the presidential suite, was then returned to what it was before. And sometimes this had cost $250,000 a time. But Mick Wood said, you know, if Stevie wants it, Stevie gets it.
Yeah, well, they were having an affair at one point, of course, but I went up to the Mayfair Hotel in London to see her once, and she had, again, the top floor, you know, the penthouse suite, but it was done out like a forest, and it had stuffed cheetahs kind of in a sort of prone position, all kind of positioned around, and pulsated palm trees and the whole works, and it was like she was sort of Tarzan's Jane holding court on this gigantic bed, and I had to interview her on the bed. It was, very surreal. But did you know the most unusual fact about Stevie for me is that she's an ordained minister?
No, I didn't. Was that when? What part of her life did that happen in?
That's relatively recently. She's ordained with the Universal Life Church, which is a non-denominational religious organisation in America. So she can conduct weddings and funerals and that kind of thing.
Good God, that's amazing. It's not like the Moonies or something, is it?
No. It's a proper church.
Yeah.
It's just non-denominational. So it's non-Roman Catholic, non-Anglican, non-Protestant, whatever. You know, it's a church for everyone.
That's amazing. And one of the favourite Fleetwood Mac songs for me of all time is Sarah, written by Stevie Nicks. And then later when I investigated the history of this song, Sarah was her best friend who Mick Fleetwood went off and started shagging when she wasn't looking, didn't he?
Oh, there was a lot of that, wasn't there? They're even weirder. She had another best friend called Robin,
yeah.
Who was a girl she'd known all her life. Mm. Robin had a small child. She was married to a guy called Kim.
Yeah.
And then Robin sadly died. So Stevie said to Kim, I suppose we'd better get married and bring up the child.
Yeah.
So they did. And of course, it crumbled spectacularly. This was never going to work.
Yeah.
But she did that to bring up this little child. But other than that, she had 5 abortions because every time she got pregnant herself, Mick Fleetwood would say to her, look, we're just about to go out on the road. Mm. You can't be pregnant on the road. You can't have a baby on tour.
Yeah.
So she had to go and dispose of her own babies. And she never had one of her own, which is really sad.
God, that is a shocking story. I just can't believe that. Having abortions just like other people would have a cocktail. I mean, gee me, that's amazing. And anyway, as you say, that's the world of rock and roll at its highest, isn't it? I saw an obituary the other day about a guy called Stephen Fay, who is described as convivial journalist author who had a distinguished career on Fleet Street. I never came across him. Apparently, he was a financial journalist and that kind of stuff. But during the course of just reading this, because my eye came to it because he was a Fleet Street journalist, it said that he was particularly good at filing live copy when things like financial stories were breaking and all that kind of stuff. Now, I always found filing live, you know, on a deadline, incredibly exciting, but very, very pressurised. But I remember you were out with a colleague of mine once on, who was it, up in Hampstead?
Boy George.
And blimey, I was getting new copy on the hour, every hour, for every deadline. I mean, it is nerve-wracking stuff, isn't it?
Well, it is, but it's, as you say, it's thrilling. Yeah. It's exciting that you can do this because it is a skill. And I was taught this by Jack Tinker, the theatre critic on the Daily Mail for many years, who had a column called Last Night's First Night by Jack Tinker.
Yeah.
And so he would go every single night to some new opening play or theatrical production of some kind.
Yeah.
And in the interval, so he didn't ever see the entire show, in the interval he had to file his review.
Yeah.
So he said, for a whole week I had to shadow him to learn the skill, you see.
Right.
This was how we did it back in the day.
Yeah.
So I would trot out and stand beside him by the payphone in the lobby of the theatre.
Yeah.
And he would call in to the copy takers, Jack Tinker here, and then he would start the whole thing, you know, point new par and all of that. And you had to say all the punctuation, all the paragraph breaks, all the italicizations, the capital letters, all of it. Yeah. You had to spell it all out.
Yeah.
Because the copy takers were funny people, weren't they?
Oh,
they were very sort of sardonic, been there, seen it.
More of this. That's what
they... Is there much more of this shit, specifically, you know, even to Jack Tinker? And so I learned at the knee, he was a tiny guy, wasn't he, Jack?
Yeah. But he was,
that was how you learned. You went out with another journalist and you shadowed them. And then to be able to do this on the road yourself, this was demonstrating the great skill of journalism, which is not only seeing the story, finding the story, getting the people, but then not having any time to actually write the damn thing, having to hit a phone somewhere.
That's right.
So we used to say our obituary would be called Pork Pie in a Phone Box, because that was a business lunch, wasn't it?
No.
While you were phoning copy in.
Yeah.
But then you had to sort of create this stuff and dictate it down the phone to somebody live who would then just file it straight to the news desk.
Oh,
I used to love that, didn't you?
Well, I did under many different circumstances. And you're absolutely right about the theatre night. First night I get invited to Mr. Kenwright's productions, Mr. Kenwright, the chairman of Everton Football Club, friend of mine. And I always keep an eye on the bloke who's doing the report for the third edition, so he has to get out at half time. You quite rightly say, dashes out, and you hear him blabbering away outside on his mobile phone. But it is an art. But I remember the two I most remember was I was following the Pope in Ireland, and it was a Saturday. And at 5 o'clock on the Saturday, the Pope actually gave an address at somewhere like Drogheda or something like that. And it was the first time he'd ever appealed to the men of violence to put down their guns. And I mean, this was, you know, worldwide news. The Pope tells the IRA, you know, cease fire and all this kind of stuff. And I got on to, I was working for an evening paper, the Birmingham Evening Mail, but I got on to my boss and said, look, I don't know what to do with this. He said, put it onto copy right now. We're going to take half of the front page of the Pink, you know, the football Pink, which was obviously a paper devoted to all the Saturday afternoon sport. Anyway, I didn't have a note in front of me. I was listening to the Pope in one ear and I was dictating down the phone to a copy taker who normally took football match reports with the other, you know, in from my other ear. And I don't know how I did it, but I got about 600 or 700 words over, almost spot on. I don't know how I did it because I wasn't very good at listening and recreating it. But it was, as you quite rightly say, all driven by adrenaline. And the only other time I remember being that sort of on the edge was when in Libya, a guard had a gun in my ribs while I was filing copy to make sure I didn't say anything that would upset the great leader, Colonel Gaddafi. So I agree.
Oh, my God. Did you need clean pants after that?
Well, not really, because they did it every time. And it became part of the, you know, part of the routine, really. But the other pressure, of course, when you were filing copy, and particularly if you worked on paper where you're up to a deadline, an evening paper or something, was there was always somebody in the old days trying to get into your phone box, and you had to literally put your back against the wall and kick out at them to stop them coming in. Because if your news editor didn't care that was somebody was giving you pressure and stick to try and get in the phone box, you just had to get the stuff over. But as you quite rightly say, terrific days. Another great female pop star who must be of your acquaintance, Kylie Minogue, has also got a birthday this week. She's 52.
Yeah, and she's the eternal child, isn't she? She's never really changed.
Yeah.
I think back to, what was she, Charlene or something in Neighbours back in the day. Seems like 100 years ago.
But she got married in that, by the way. Sorry, 20 million British viewers tuned in to that Australian soap to see her get married to Jason Donovan.
Like the royal wedding, wasn't it?
Yeah.
But yeah, she never seems to have changed or aged, and she's been through cancer scare, and she had cancer treatment for quite some years. She lost all her hair.
Yeah.
That all came back. She's a terrific trooper. She's a fabulous singer, and she seems to have a really nice personality. She's the girl next door. To the point that years ago, when I shared a news agency with Roger Taverner and Gary Jenkins, Martin Palmer,
sort
of all Fleet Street journalists, called Media Business International, we at the height of her popularity, the four of us decided we were going to write a book about her, which we sold to Omnibus, the rock and roll publisher.
Yeah.
And we literally locked ourselves in our office down in Chelsea for a week. And we wrote it in parts. So we managed to write a 70,000 word book between the four of us in 7 days.
That is absolutely amazing. Writing books, which you do, of course, as a profession, I've written a few books. I find it so intensely boring, Leslie, and honestly, and intensely hard work, fact-checking, you know, because the person you're writing about can't remember most of their lives and all that kind of stuff, particularly if they're footballers and they've played thousands of games. They can't remember which game, you know, they were talking about. I don't know how you do it. And I could only ever, by the way, so you said 70,000 words. On a good day, I could knock out 3,000 words with a bit of research before I was just spent. To write 70,000 words in how long?
It was a week, but there were four of us.
Yeah, but nevertheless, you know, you all had to sort of cross-inform each other, didn't you, and all that kind of stuff. I mean, fantastic.
It was fun. I wouldn't want to do it again. But it's interesting what you say about people not being able to remember their lives, because, yes, there is a lot of fact-checking. I wrote a memoir published last year, Tumbling Dice, and I found it difficult to remember much of my own life. I had to do an awful lot of research. Mm. And a few people said to me, well, surely you remember that. It was your life. You lived it.
Yeah.
But you still have to go back. I'm one of these people who keeps all my diaries. I've got all my diaries right back to when I was about 5 years old.
Yeah.
And every single thing is there. Every, not sort of dear diary, today I fell in love with the postman kind of thing. But you know, just where I was, what time, who I was with, who I had lunch with, what gig I went to see, all that. Mm. So all the dates and times and everything were logged. Mm. I just had to colour it in. Mm. But there was still research to be done. So I wonder, if you had to write your own autobiography, Could you remember most of your life?
Yes, I can. I can remember most of my life. And I go over it in my head all the time because I'm, you see, I always said I'd never write my own life story. Not that many people would be very interested, but I wouldn't write it until I actually decided to retire. But I've not retired because I don't want to retire. And I think I'll die before I write a book because I will never accept I'm retired. You know, even in lockdown here, I've been doing some live radio and live TV, podcasts with yourself and with other people. And I just want to keep going and hope that all opens up again the way it was when we get going. So I will not write my life story because that to me will be an admission it's all over. And I
no, you're wrong. I mean, certain people like David Niven, you know, they'll write one sort of 20 years in and then they'll write another one 25 years later. You can keep bringing them out, you see, and you've got so many stories to tell. I think it would be fascinating.
I wouldn't get them all in one book. In fact, funny you should say that, but my very good colleague Mr. Brazil, we speak daily in lockdown to keep each other's spirits up, so to speak. He's just completed his second life story. I did the first one 15 years ago. That was a bestseller. That got onto the Sunday Times bestseller list. And somebody came along to him and said, you know, isn't it time now for a rewrite, an update? And it came to me and I just could not face the sheer torture of writing another book. So I passed it on to another guy to write it for him. But you're absolutely right. Al certainly didn't give up when his first life story came out. He's not given up now with his second life story having come out. Talking about your life, by the way, Leslie Ann, and you know, you go back over the years and things you remember. I read a remarkable story about a woman who's just moved for the 44th time and she's not yet 60 years of age. So if you say that as an adult, she's probably had about 40 years of life, and she's moved for the 44th time and is still unhappy and says she won't be there for probably another 12 months because already she feels the vibes are wrong in her house. I mean, I've quite liked moving around during my life because each move has meant a new job and a new adventure, but I do find moving house terribly stressful, and there's no way in the world, I don't think I'll ever do it again. If I want to buy another place just to use, then that's fine, but I can't imagine moving out of my home.
Well, I get what she means, but you know, the problem she has is that she is taking herself to every new house that she moves into. So she's got a problem there. The thing about moving, it is the third most stressful thing you can do after divorce and death. Yeah. It does represent a transition in your life, and it's about change and unfamiliarity. Mm. And if you don't like unfamiliarity, that causes you stress and anxiety. Mm. So this lady seems to me to need to come to terms with herself as a personality and then get her routine in order. Mm. Because when you're moving house all the time, all that goes out the window, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. You're absolutely right. I just can't bear the thought anymore of having to buy furniture and move everything. In fact, last time I moved, I just left everything there. I couldn't be bothered. You know, I'm not taking this anywhere. I need new stuff anyway. And off I went. Okay, folks, you are, of course, listening to Life on Planet Porky. Thank you for being with us today. Leslie Ann, of course, in fine form, telling us some of the secrets from the rock chick writer's world, which she has inhabited all her life. Talking about rock stars, Leslie Ann, I read a review of a book today about a group called the Beastie Boys. Now, I've heard of the Beastie Boys, but I've no idea what they were all about, what they're up to. Like, it's an absurd name, Beastie Boys. Did that mask the fact that they weren't very good musicians?
No, they were great, actually, but they were a little bit sort of after my time, I suppose.
Yeah.
I wasn't really on Fleet Street by the 90s.
No.
I'd moved on. I was having children, bringing up a family. So I didn't get to cover any of those sort of bands, but I was well aware of them. Yeah. I listened to the Beastie Boys now. I think the kind of frontman died not long ago.
Really?
And yeah, so the music all did the rounds again. And I had a good listen. I thought, what fantastic rock and roll this really was.
Yeah, really. Yeah. Well, my problem is, and I've said this a million times, everybody knows it, basically after the Beatles and, you know, all the 70s greats and then a little bit in the 80s, and then Oasis. I lost interest in all sorts of music, so I wouldn't know anything about them all. Now, Leslie Ann, you are the mother of three children, okay? And I came
across... Thanks for reminding me, because I do sometimes forget.
Yeah, that's right, yeah, absolutely. All who appear to be doing extremely well in their various careers, by the way, so that's something to be very happy about. But I've seen a story since I last since we last spoke, and it's about a little 4-year-old boy who, reading a maths whiz, enters Mensa at 4 years of age. A boy who is more brilliant than Mozart. I just know that kid is going to have a dreadful life, don't you?
Well, it's very strange. This is a little boy called Isaac Miller, and at 4 years old, yeah, he's got an IQ of 154,
yeah,
become a member of Mensa. He knows the alphabet in four languages, and he taught himself Greek and Arabic from YouTube videos. Now, what kind of family are we talking here that allows their toddler,
yeah,
to watch Greek and Arabic lessons on YouTube videos?
Yeah.
This smacks to me of a family who are trying to create an Einstein.
Mm-hmm. To me, the one I always remember was that young girl who went to Cambridge with her father, who was an academic, and they used to ride round Cambridge together on a tandem, wearing mortarboards and cloaks. Do you remember? Her name was Ruth something, and that was when she was about sort of 13 or 14, and you know, she had such an unusual life that, you know, marriage to a normal person, all that kind of stuff, was always going to be a problem and all that. So all I see from day one, when you've got a kid of four who's a genius, is huge, huge problems. What would you have done if you'd found your child was a genius?
Well, I think, you know, it's a very unusual scenario, isn't it? I think you would see the specialists,
yeah,
you would seek help, you would try and find out what would be the best way to give this child a proper childhood,
yeah,
while nurturing their obvious intelligence, mm, and skills. Because what you want them to always be able to do is to fit in with other kids their own age.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you're depriving them of a childhood. And once you've been through that, you can never get that back.
Mm.
And so really, as a parent, your responsibility is to allow them a childhood.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. It's all about letting a child be a child, be normal, all that kind of stuff. My own father was very, very keen on education. You know, he sort of left school because of the war, joined the Royal Navy and all that kind of stuff. And he had the determination that his children wouldn't be deprived of the education that he'd missed out on, all that kind of stuff. But he was very, very demonic about, you know, doing homework and having extra work to do in the holidays and, you know, working over the weekends and all that. And in the end, it just bored me to death, honestly. And so if I'd have been allowed to go along at the normal pace that all my pals did, then I probably would have ended up going to university, maybe even Oxford or something like that. But I got so bored because of parental pressure and teacher pressure, I gave up. But I'm very glad about that, because if I'd have gone on to be an academic, I wouldn't have been a journalist, and then I wouldn't be sitting here now talking to you, Leslie Ann. So you have reason to be grateful to my father for that as well.
I will praise him for the rest of time. I am indebted to him endlessly.
That's right. One thing that was always difficult at home, even when we were little kids, was watching the telly, because, we used to sit around with our mum and watch Coronation Street and Emergency Ward 10 and all that. But then as soon as we heard our father's car, oof, we all rushed off, you know, to get back to our home.
The drama on. Make sure we're watching something worthy.
Yes, exactly. That's right. Yeah. Like the 4-year-old genius. But talking about tellies, I read a remarkable story this week that Glasgow is the telly capital of Britain. Okay. And the reason is because in Glasgow, more people have got 5 televisions per household than any other region or any other city in the United Kingdom. Now, quite unfairly, this report was interpreted in one account of it that I saw as Glaswegian people being couch potatoes, slobs, sitting in front of telly, drinking cans of beer, smoking cigarettes, and couldn't pull themselves away from the telly, even to the extent where they have to have the same programme on in 5 different rooms. I think that's a bit unfair, because I've got, how many have I got? I've got 4 tellies in the, in the Porky penthouse, which I'm talking to you from now, and they're mostly on all of the time, but they are tellies that I need. And I wonder whether you've got over your sort of, you know, news junkie type period we all went through in Fleet Street, and can you leave it alone at the moment, or do you have to be in touch all day like I do?
Well, I've just done a quick tot up. We've actually got 5 televisions in my house. So there's one in the kitchen, there's one in my bedroom, there's one in my son's, my daughter's, and my other daughter's bedroom. So that's 5.
Yeah.
My mother, who lives alone, she's 85, she has 4 tellies. Yeah, she's got one in the living room, the kitchen, the front sort of study, and in her bedroom. I can remember a time when we did not have a television at all. And I can remember when colour television arrived, which was in 1969. I'm not a big telly watcher. I tend to like programs like Michael Portillo doing train journeys across Asia and that kind of thing. I don't much go for dramas. I'd rather read a book.
Yeah.
But I like to have access to television, obviously, for news.
Yeah, well, that's why I've got it on. So, for instance, in the mornings, right, I've got one in my kitchen, where I spend most of the morning. Then I can pass from my kitchen to my lounge, where I've got the biggest telly in the place. Then I've got one in the bedroom, and I've got one in my study. And they're on all the time, but they're on 4 different programmes. So I would normally have, for instance, Piers in the kitchen, then I'd have BBC in the lounge, then I might have Sky in the study, and then I might have something else in the... something like CNN or something like that in the bedroom, which I wouldn't really go into. But I do feel a sense of loss if there's not the noise of something in the background in my house.
I think that's because you live by yourself.
Maybe. Or maybe it's because I lived in New York once. And when you live in an apartment on Manhattan, there is constant noise 24 hours a day. You know, as you well know, you've been there plenty of times. You know, the hooting of horns and sirens and klaxons and just the general noise of the city. So I don't like to, to phrase the great Simon and Garfunkel song title. I do not like the sound of silence. I don't think it's good for you. I think.
Now, do you know who that was about, by the way?
Go on, tell me.
That song was about the assassination of JFK.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, why? Did the world go quiet after the assassination or something?
Yeah, there's a lot of sort of allusion in that piece of songwriting. They never really explained it, but they did say that they were asked to write a song about that, and that's what they came up with.
I can imagine that. That's another one, by the way. We talked in a previous podcast about the split of Pink Floyd, and the two main characters there didn't speak to each other for 10 years. Didn't the same thing happen to Simon and Garfunkel? Didn't they?
They had a terrible falling out.
Yeah.
And it was primarily because Paul Simon wrote the songs and Art Garfunkel made them his own with that sort of angelic voice of his.
Yeah.
And I went to see Paul Simon in Hyde Park about 2 years ago.
Right.
It was a big Hyde Park, his sort of farewell tour it was.
Yeah.
And he actually sang Bridge Over Troubled Water, and he said, "I'm reclaiming my song."
Mm.
Because I think the world thought that Art Garfunkel wrote it, and of course he didn't.
They did. I was only about 15 when Bridge Over Troubled Waters came out, because that was the cover name of the LP, wasn't it? It was both the LP name and the single name. And there was a big bridge on the front cover, wasn't there? A picture of a big bridge. And you're absolutely right. The everlasting memory associated with that song is Art Garfunkel sitting in front of a piano on Top of the Pops singing and no sign of Paul Simon. And I thought for years that they'd split up and Art Garfunkel had written this brilliant song, Bridge Over Troubled Waters, to establish himself as a top musician. But in fact, he had nothing to do with it.
Well, they did have a reunion, and the concert was in Central Park, and it didn't work out because really they knew each other when they were very young. They were Tom and Jerry when they started out.
That's right.
That's what they called themselves to begin with. But then, really they clashed as characters and they are very different. Paul Simon is a very sweet, loving, understanding, humble sort of guy, really. Art Garfunkel, from what I've perceived, and I have had some dealings with him, is a bit of an arse, to be honest, a very arrogant person.
Yeah.
He's lost all that sort of baby fluffy hair now, and he looks a bit sort of like an old troll, out of Harry Potter or something.
Yeah.
But a person who writes poetry, he now doesn't sing very much on stage. He recites his own poetry. It's not very good, I've got to say.
That doesn't sound very good to me. I think Paul Simon is such a genius songwriter. I mean, some of his songs leave me breathless. 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover. And
they'll slip out the back, Jack.
Absolutely.
Make a new chance, Dan.
I remember once I was going out with a young lady, okay, and we went into a pub where they had these incredible machines called jukeboxes, right? And I went and got the drinks and put them on the table. And then I went over to the jukebox, right? And I put some music on. And the first one was 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover.
Oh, yeah. Very appropriate.
Yeah.
good one, Mike.
No, I promise you, there was no connection there. I was very happily in this relationship with this young lady. And you know, no way in the world was I trying to give her some subliminal message.
No, but she would have read everything into that. You can bet.
I am not joking. I sat down, her face was like thunder, and I said, what's wrong with you? She said, is this a message to me? I said...
There you go.
Yeah, I said, what message? She said, this Paul Simon song, 50 Ways to Leave. Do you want to leave me? Or do you want me to leave you? Do you want me to walk out of here? And she did end up walking out. She invented this incredible, you know, scenario where I was sending her, like, almost, you know, messages from space and all that, get out of my life and all that kind of stuff. And that was all down to Paul Simon. But
have you ever considered that that might have been subliminal? And even though you didn't necessarily realise it, with hindsight, you could have thought, well, you know, actually, maybe I was meant to do that.
Well, funnily enough, ever since whenever I've heard that record, the one line that really intrigues me is the second or third line, which says something like, I want to help you in your struggle to be free. And I thought, I quite understand that. There's so many things in life that you're struggling to be free of. I'm not trying to get all sort of, you know, like mind controlling now, but you know, you struggle to get free of relationships. You struggle to get free of connections to your job. You struggle to get free from family situations and tie-ups. You struggle to get free from your own mind sometimes, don't you?
Oh, yeah, sure. I think that the truth is we always want the other thing. So whatever it is we've got, yeah. You know, if we're married, we'd quite like to be single again. If we're on our own, wouldn't it be nice to meet someone?
Yeah.
You've got this family sort of you lugging around with you. You know, wouldn't it be nice to be able to do your own thing, not have the responsibility? So the grass is always greener. Yeah. And freedom does seem to be the answer.
Yeah.
But when we get it, we don't always want it.
No, I totally agree with you. And just getting back to tellies for a moment, you're right about colour telly. We got a colour telly in 1968 in May because Everton...
Oh, you got it before it came out then.
Well, is that right, CC? You asked me if I could remember all my life. All I know is... Everton got to the FA Cup final in 1968 against West Brom. We'd won it 2 years earlier in 1966. We were expected to win it again because West Brom weren't a very fashionable team, but they had a centre-forward called Jeff Astle, who your father will have written about many, many times and has subsequently been the subject of concussion in footballers, you know, for many years. Obviously, Jeff's been dead many years. But he scored the one goal in extra time, which beat us 1-0. And I was out the game for a week. I was about 14 at the time or something like that. And I just couldn't cope for a week. We'd lost the cup final to West Brom. But I am almost certain I was watching Everton in their change strip of yellow shirts and blue shorts because West Brom played in blue and white stripes. And you're telling me that colour telly didn't come along till 69.
Well, I could well have remembered that wrongly, but I can remember the first thing I saw in colour, which was Doctor Who, and it terrified the life out of me. I spent probably the next week behind the sofa.
Yeah, I can imagine that, yeah. I love Doctor Who for the music and the Daleks, but I didn't like all the creepy crawlies. I never do. Now, as we speak, we're not sure whether there's going to be a rocket launched by Elon Musk to put two spacemen into the... new space station, the space station. And for the first time ever, this is being funded by a private company Elon Musk's in charge of. I have to say, Leslie Ann, in this day and age, when governments are running up tens of billions of pounds of debt because of the COVID epidemic, haven't we got better bloody things to spend our money on than sending money into space? Because why are they going into space anymore? We don't want the moon. Nobody needs the moon. The moon's useless. So what are we still doing it for?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? The word lunacy comes from luna, meaning the moon. People sort of have gone start raving mad.
Yeah.
I think that NASA is a machine for spending money. It's stuck in the 1960s.
Mm.
I think Bush made it worse, didn't he, when he was desperate to stay ahead of the Chinese in the new space race,
yes,
that he sanctioned a $400 billion space program in 2004.
Yeah.
I think now it's all making shallow gestures in space.
Yeah.
And it's assumed to be some sort of indicator of a nation's virility, I think.
Yeah.
Why are the Americans so insecure?
Yeah.
It's obscenely expensive. I blame Stephen Hawking to some extent,
right,
because he did urge us to colonize other planets to ensure mankind's survival. That's probably pointless. The Earth is probably doomed, but going anywhere successfully seems very unlikely to me.
Yeah.
Do you know that a spaceship capable of traveling 1,000,000 miles an hour,
yeah,
1,000,000 miles an hour,
yes,
would take 4,000 years to reach the nearest star system that might be able to sustain us. So I looked up President Eisenhower,
yeah,
who had some things to say about space travel, and he said, every rocket fired signifies, in the final sense, a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and are not clothed. And I think that's the bottom line.
Yeah.
People are starving in this world and we're sending rockets to space.
Yeah, no, that's a very good quote. And you're absolutely bang on, by the way, when you say it's all about politics, because it was JFK, of course, John F. Kennedy, who said they would get a man to space and return him safely to Earth within that decade of the 60s. And that was purely a political battle against the will of communism and the Russians. It was as simple as that. But you're absolutely right, you say, now we've established it, now that the Americans got there first, now they've planted the flag, I don't know why anybody else does it. What you've just said, by the way, about how long it would take to get to the nearest star that could sustain us, I didn't realise, because I'm very thick, until about a few years ago, that the speed of light, when it's expressed in light years, I thought, oh, I see. So light just travels around for a few years. I didn't realise that the speed of light means that one light year is light travelling at the speed it travels for a year. and the distances are incalculable. I mean, just incalculable. Why would you send a man to Mars? He'd probably be dead by the time he got there, and he certainly wouldn't.
Well, obviously he would, 4,000 years later. I mean, it's pointless. It's utterly pointless. We should all stop. It's big boys with toys, and it's a waste of money, and let's feed the people we have.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that, and I just don't see the point of it. One last story about COVID-19, just to sign off here, and this quite revolted me. Two friends craving a McDonald's after 8 weeks of lockdown took a 250-mile round trip to their nearest drive-thru. When they got there, they ordered a large Big Mac with Coke, large six-nugget meal with Coke, two double cheeseburgers, one McChicken sandwich, one regular cheeseburger, one fillet of fish, and they ate it all in 15 minutes in the car park and then turned round and drove 125 miles back from Peterborough to Hull. Are they mad?
And they were sick on the way and spent about 200 quid on petrol.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Maddest story I've read about the lockdown ever. Well, Leslie Ann, that brings us to the end of another Life on Planet Porky. Thank you very much for joining me. Where can people get a hold of you when they want you?
Oh, on Twitter at LAJ Writer.
That's right. And I'm Mike Parry 8, or you can get us on planetporkypod@gmail.com. Love to hear from you. So I want to say thanks, folks. Keep contacting us. We love hearing from you. Do we not, Leslie Ann?
Oh, we love it. And do stay sane and stay safe until next time.
Absolutely right. And let's hope that the Porky campaign to get the pubs open bears fruit. Cheer, everybody. See you next time.
Garfunkel, from what I've perceived, and I have had some dealings with him, is a bit of an arse, to be honest. A very arrogant person.
Yeah.
He's lost all that sort of baby fluffy hair now.
Yeah.
And he looks a bit sort of like an old troll, you know, out of Harry Potter or something.
Yeah.